is very close to assembly language. You can pretty much see it, an experienced person can visualize the assembly language they're writing when they're writing C code. That does not apply to C++ in any way. So we started a system where we taught C in the first course, and then we did do some C++, a simple kind of what we thought was a natural extension of C++ to a semester long project in the second course. But in our hearts, we knew that that would never work, and before long there would be people demanding that we have C in the fourth course, C++ in the first course, Python in the first course, all of the first course, and then we have some course down the road that merges all of it together. And so that's what we're doing now, but that was after we retired, so we don't have anything.
The courses you're talking about, is that the Techni approach?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Just wanted to make sure that I was thinking. I was going to ask you about that, but you've spoken to it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that makes sense to, you know, just learn one language really well and be able to do all of the things you might need to do and then branch off into other languages.
Yeah, my contention is, and I use myself as an example, I only learned in class one language.
Mm-hmm.
All the others, I just taught myself. It was easy enough to do.
Yeah.
You just look at some examples, and there's an old truism around that says there's only one COBOL program in the world. Grace Hopper wrote it in 1958, and since then everybody started with it, and then they modify it because COBOL had all this superstructure that was pained to try to memorize all the things you did. So it was always easier just to take an old COBOL program that worked and then change the data names and the procedure names and just build in the infrastructure. So yeah, so people that the key thing is that learning code is not problem solving, and anybody who can problem solve and knows how to code in a single language can readily learn to code in another.
Mm-hmm.
So for that matter, and so we had Java in the mix for a long time here. I don't know if Java's still in the mix or not, but the Java language is, it had a lot of, particularly in academia, people loved it, but it really never caught on. A lot of people still confuse Java with JavaScript, and JavaScript is a programming language that's used to build complicated web pages. Has nothing to do, it doesn't look like Java, doesn't taste like Java, has nothing to do with Java. And I think, I don't know if they invented the name as a way to try to attract attention or tongue in cheek, who knows. But
so they're not connected at all?
No.
Wow.
And so there are Java applets, you may have heard of, and those Java applets are things that run in web pages, but they have nothing to do with JavaScript. So just another way to confuse the enemy, I guess.
So I was looking at your CV. You were the director of graduate affairs for about 10 years, is that correct? Can you tell me about that experience and if it affected, you know, the way you look at academia or the way you approach teaching now?
No, it was interesting because it was a time of great transition. incredible transition from the perspective of internationalization of the graduate program, not the undergraduate program at all. But when I started, probably less than 50% of the applicants to the graduate program were international. Most were American. And going back to the late 1980s, there was maybe two or three internationals a year. By the early 2000s, I remember one year we had 400 applications from India, 25 from the U.S. And by the time I left, there was still not a flood from China. It was, but now, I don't know, I haven't looked at the numbers in detail in 15 years. So now, I would be amazed if there's not a lot more from China, maybe as many as from India. So I had a affirmative action program that I would admit any American who looked like they had a prayer of success and offer them financial aid in the form of assistantship. But you understand when you're saying you got 25 applicants, some of those applicants have also applied to UNC, Georgia Tech, and other places with better name, UVA than Clemson's. And if they get in there, they're not gonna come here. So I knew that by offering 25, I might get 10. But I also knew we needed 40 to 50. So I knew I wasn't going to grossly disadvantage really good international students, because the top internationals were all going to get aid offers as well. And not all of them would come here either. So at the bottom line was that during near the end of my era, we had probably maybe 150 total grad students, and this is total all year, not just applicants, and maybe 20 Americans, and maybe 10 or 20 Chinese, and most of the rest were from India. And they were great people. I tremendously enjoyed working with them. Had a lot of them as master's advisees, and they were competent and hardworking, and they sought out difficult courses. Like the last time I taught my network protocol implementation course in spring of 2011, it was where you would build a hypothetical TCP-like transport protocol on an actual working Linux kernel and get your, and then we'd build some applications. You'd have to demonstrate that it actually sent bytes across a real network without crashing. And that was where I reinvented the slogan that I always put on the board at the start of that class. It's no coincidence there's only one letter difference between networking and not working. And that's right. And so it was a difficult course, but the last time I taught it, I've got a picture at home. I meant to bring it in that the class wanted to take with me. At the end, it was 10 Indian students and one American. And so that was kind of the ratio back then. But it irritates me when I read these things on various websites that all these tech companies are firing their Americans and hiring Indians. They hired every American we could produce, but they hired all our Indians too. So it's not that they don't, and they hired the Indians for the same starting pay they hired the Americans. So if you walk the halls of Network Appliance or Apple or Microsoft in the technical departments, you'll see that there's probably not 10% of the employees are Americans. And so I would always respond, yeah, that's right, because earning a master's in computer science, even though it's a guarantee of a high-paying, interesting job, is a job Americans just won't do anymore, which is sad, but it's true. Because, I mean, we were, at the same time we were getting 25 applicants total to our graduate program, we were graduating over 100 CS majors every year. But for whatever reason, they wanted to go work in the bank and print bank statements, which I cannot think of a worse job. Is just a mundane business process programming job.
Yeah. But
a master's graduate back then could start with pay in the 90 to 100, depending on, and these bank jobs paid 50 to maybe 60. And the American undergraduate said, why would I want to spend two more years in school when I could get $50,000 a year now? So that was the way it worked, I guess. I never interviewed the ones that just left, you know, but without the majority that didn't apply to grad school anywhere, even though there were many really good ones that didn't.
Well, I mean, I imagine there's good jobs to be had with a computer science undergrad as well, though. Or,
well, if to go to there's a fundamental difference there. And yeah, there are good jobs out there. There are jobs that self-taught people take, particularly like web development is one. So yeah, but the jobs that I think are interesting, and maybe that's it. It's just me and the students that did come to graduate school are the jobs in the tech industry developing new technology. So like IBM, Apple, Oracle, Intel. So versus the job applying existing technology, which would be the bank jobs.
Right.
And so it is definitely true that in the tech development sector, the companies are strongly prefer graduate degrees, and they will look at an undergrad, but the undergrad has to pretty much have just outstanding test scores, straight A grades, and super glowing testimonials from professors. We've had some that went direct, but they're very rare. So somebody that, and even the banks won't hire a C student. So that's what I told the undergrads was that, if you graduate with a, there's very, very few things worth less than a computer science degree with a C average in your undergraduate courses. Because your only job option really is going to be selling computers at Best Buy. And so, I mean, they probably make good money if they're good at selling computers at Best Buy. But nobody wants a C student for a development job, even the bank, because they basically to become a C student, they either had to have no aptitude or generate no effort. And so either one of those is not what you want in a technology job.
That makes sense. So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, any research initiatives you've been involved in since your time at Clemson, what your research generally focuses on, that kind of thing?
Oh, it's funny. Some professors pick one thing as a grad student, and the whole rest of their life is like that. And so, for example, a retired guy that's well known named Steve Hedetnimi, who was in our faculty, was super well known in graph theory, but in a sub area of graph theory called domination and graph. And he's acknowledged as one of the total experts in the world in that, but he never had interest outside that little niche. And one of our current faculty, Andrew Duhosky, for example, started working on eye tracking when he was a PhD student at Texas A&M. And he's now approaching age 60, I think, and has still all 100% of his work has been in eye tracking. So for an old guy like me, the landscape has changed massively since 1974. When in the first year we were created in 78, our teaching loads were three courses a semester, or six a year, and all undergraduate. We didn't have a graduate program. So basically there was no real research expectation and no real research going on. Then in the 80s, it changed, and the research focus was on generating money, external funding. And so I had a bunch of contracts, or two contracts, with the Defense Department. One of them was, let's see if I can talk about this. Command and control and communications countermeasures. So it was basically electronic warfare. And I won't go much beyond that. But so it brought in a good bit of money, but it generated no publications, because if you publish it, we'll have to put you in jail. But that was fine then, because that was the focus, was bring in money so we can build the department. And then we had another little, Jack Peck got a contract with the Defense Logistics Agency that built the Clemson Apparel Research Facility. And so I worked on that, and we developed an operating system for a little micro device that was used in textile shops. And so, I don't know, we may have gotten a small paper or two out of it, but there was no real major research in that. And so, and I worked with NCR doing, looking into the effects of careful page placement in memory management. So the objective was when you page things in and out, place them so that you minimize high-speed cache pollution. And so that was a real research area, and we got some papers out of that and a little bit of research money. But then it became apparent about 1990 that you needed some more high-powered papers if you were ever going to get promoted to professor. So I switched gears again and got a good dual advantage job. A friend of mine hooked me up as a consultant with IBM in Charlotte. And for 11 years, I worked half-time. I'd spend one day a week in Charlotte and a lot of nights at home on their project while still working full-time here. And so that project was, how best say it? You know what a personal bank check looks like. I think people still use them, not only credit cards now, but, and you know, there's a field up where you write the numbers of the amount you're doing. Well, in the 90s, each of the bigger banks cleared tens of millions of those checks a day at their bank check clearinghouse. And what that meant was that hundreds or thousands of workers had to sit there, talk about a bad job, all day. And a check would flash by on a transport, and they would have to key in the amount that the person had written. And so IBM and others decided that, hey, it was, banks would like it, and we could make a lot of money if we built a system where we could automate the scanning of the checks. So a big pile of checks would go into a transport, which would go to a scanner. The scanner would take a fairly high resolution picture of the check, and the check would then go off and something would happen to it. Then from then on, the image would be what was dealt with, not the paper check. Then the next step was to write a program or a collection of programs that could read the handwritten amounts on the check. And as you might imagine, that was a very hard thing to do.
I imagine. But obviously it was successful because I can deposit checks with my phone now.
Yeah.
By taking a picture of it. So
yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it was an interesting job, and I mean, you think about depositing a check, and you would see things like Riot figuring out the amounts on a check. You would see things that look like that, and so you could say, well, that looks like a 123.08 to me, and so it was really a thankless job, because we would get pretty good at it, and pretty good was being able to recognize 2/3 of them correctly. And then the other part was to understand what you can't deal with and send them off to a human. What they didn't want, like, is mistakes, mm-hmm. where we think we recognized it, but we got it wrong. So the objective was recognize as many as you can, but keep the errors under 1%. And so we made it up to the 60s. And we would demo this to some bank of executives, and we'd show them some things that we did right. And they'd say, well, show us one you couldn't get. And we would do like, well, here's one. It usually involves some sort of touching numbers. 27802, but the seven's connected to the two. It's so on the computer programming side, the problem is figuring out where to make the cuts mm-hmm. when you know you've got this big collection of pixels that goes too far to be one number. Somewhere you got to cut it apart. And so that was my part of the puzzle. But we would show them one of these and we'd say, yeah, we rejected that. We couldn't do it. And the guy said, my six-year-old daughter could recognize that. And we would say, well, you're right. I bet she could. She's a smart little girl. So most humans can't, but our computers just... And so you hear so much about AI now. And to me, that's kind of an amorphous, meaningless term. Back then, I guess people would call this AI. And I finally used a neural network to develop the system for figuring out where to cut attached numbers apart. And so that led to three papers in international journals, and that with the rest of my money and my other less significant papers got me promoted to professor about 1994. and so that was kind of a summation of my career. Was so I worked on that problem from 1986 till 1997, when IBM sold the division that owned the product to a company called Check Solutions, and that they shut down the project, or they took it in house, and all of us full timers and the consultants at IBM. Full-timers were farmed out to some other job, and the consultants were just sent home. And so, so that's what's fun to me, was going from, and the papers came out in the early 90s. So going from, I'd never I knew what an image was. I knew how they were represented in the computer, but I'd never messed with recognition. Going from never having messed with to paper an international journal in 5 years, I thought that was fun and a good sign. And so that's, I've never wanted to get pigeonholed into what, you know, just eye tracking or whatever. One. And so Geist was like that with me. And so he worked in queuing theory and operating systems, and then he branched off into graphics. Mm-hmm. And he and I did a lot of work both in the queuing theory operating system stuff after I got promoted, and also then later in the graphics, and the Techni project was an offshoot of the graphics work. And then back in the 80s, I started our first graduate courses in networking, and I continued them all along, but I never really pursued networking and research. And then in early 2000s, we hired this fellow, a new PhD, but an older guy who worked at IBM named Jim Martin from NC State. And he was working at IBM, I think. No, he worked at IBM, but when we hired him, anyway, he was in probably around 40 when we hired him. And he and I did a lot of work and published a good number of papers in computer networking. And as guys got more and more deeper into the graphics, I got more and more interested in the networking. And so our research in that area kind of diverged, but at the same time, just our general love of learning new stuff kept us working together. And so in 2010, somebody at Toyota Research got our names and invited us up, 2009, I guess, to talk to him at the TRD facility in Salisbury. And so we went up and he said, yeah, we're interested in your, they were interested in some stuff using GPUs, because they had a lot of computing stuff that was high intensity and they thought maybe GPUs could facilitate it. And it turned out that we did some stuff involving GPUs, but that never really rung their chimes. And so we instead worked 10 years on very practical aspects of capturing telemetry from their race cars and NASCAR, and analyzing it, making it available to them in real time, and that was again a completely new thing for both of us, but we found it great fun, and they were kind enough to offer us their skybox seats, air-conditioned, soundproof race box at Bristol for a couple of races. Bristol is without a doubt the best place to ever watch a NASCAR race. You've been to Bristol?
I have. Yeah. My grandparents are, well, cool. My grandfather is a big NASCAR fan, so growing up we went a few times.
Yeah.
I imagine the skybox is a better experience.
Yeah. It was definitely quieter. Free beer, free cold beer. One time we got a pit pass, and before the race started, we were able to go down there, and there's a tunnel at the end of the track. I'm not sure, it's probably the east end, southeast end, and we went under that tunnel and got up. We were able to wander around in the pits, and we're there at the start of the race. And one of the Toyota pits was at the very end of, they switch which is the front and the back stretch from straight. It was the front straight then, but. And so we were standing beside that pit box. And when the cars were coming into turn one, and I mean, I'd seen a lot of NASCAR on TV and a lot from the skyboxes, but you never got the impression you did standing 50 feet away from those guys as they entered the turns. It was just unbelievable. And probably if you were down near the front row in the stands, you would get that same view of the just incredible. And you're just like, how in the hell are these guys not all end up in the wall? but they didn't. And so we enjoyed that. And so we had a system that Blade Center, which had like 42 individual computer systems that were pluggable blades in a 19-inch chassis that was about 6 feet tall, and there's a lab down there. And so NASCAR had this system then called RaceView that you could log into it on the web, and you could select two cars, and as they went around the track, it would show you on the screen their speed, RPM, percent throttle, and percent brake. And so we built a system that, we started out just one, and then we ran it on for multiple cars on 16 blades, which put, you know, it on the virtual screen on the blade, which was just, it was a, you know, a bitmap, but it was showing the Windows VM's screen, and it showed this race view window. And so you could screen scrape it, that is, grab a hold of the contents of the window, and then use some of my recognition technology to read off the RPM, speed, throttle, and brake, and then log it. And we did that like 10 times a second. And so then our buddy at Toyota came up with an algorithm to convert throttle and RPM to gas consumption. And the NASCAR cars don't have fuel gauges, or at least they didn't back then. And so running out of gas was always a, you know, you if you watch races, you heard of, oh God, he's saving now. And so they literally would reduce throttle and slow down a little when they were about to run out. And so if they could know better, it would be a big advantage. And so we were able to capture that data, run the algorithm, and feed it back to the pit box within 30 seconds of real time. And so NASCAR credited us once for winning a race in Charlotte with that data. So that was, again, one of the really fun things
that we
did. That, you know, just so doing that, and the images where you're actually solving a real problem in the real world was always more appealing to me. And some of the same thing in the networking world. Jim and I, we did a study of, you know, cable TV internet support is asymmetric in a way that upstream is kind of crippled by definition, because most internet traffic is downstream anyway. But it turned out that BitTorrent was just destroying the ISP's cable plants, because of what would happen is that people were running BitTorrent clients on their cable PC, and they would download some pirated new movie and put it on their computer. And then BitTorrent, by definition, advertises, hey, here's a spot where this movie is available. And so then instead of having 90%, they'd do one download, and then they'd have 50 concurrent uploads of this damn movie. And it was just killing the upstream performance. And so we did a quantitative analysis of exactly how that worked. And that was actually used by Comcast in a presentation before the FCC where Comcast was trying to defend their practice of stifling BitTorrent, because they claimed BitTorrent was ruining the experience for everybody else. And that was when a lot of stupid people were screaming about network neutrality and you shouldn't be able to do that. But the design of the DOCSIS cable network protocol was just such that it could not stand. It was not designed for and could not stand many systems that were serving as giant high volume web servers. They were designed, the network, the protocols were designed to have people downloading stuff and sending ACKs back for packets. And so there's no way to make it work right if you don't do something about BitTorrent. So that was another example of a practical application of of some of the stuff that I worked on, but that was with Jim Martin.
Yeah, thank you. So at the end of our interviews, we generally kind of like, you know, because there's no way I can ask you about everything, right? Yeah. But is there anything in particular that, you know, we haven't talked about today that, you know, is imperative to you that we should get on the record?
No, I think I did a sneaky job of, of twisting every question into something I wanted to talk about.
So. Hey, and I appreciate that.
I think that pretty much sums up 50 years.
Okay.
And it's hard to believe that a year from next August the 15th will be the 50th anniversary of my first day on the job.
Yeah, I imagine not just computer science, but Clemson in general has changed a lot since.
Yeah. I mean, I've enjoyed most all of it, and I'm still, I can't, well, maybe go back even farther. When I was 10 years old in 1956, my dad used to bring the family to either a UT game, we lived in Asheville, so we'd go to a UT game in Knoxville or a Clemson game in Clemson because they were both roughly 100 miles from Asheville. And so back then I'd probably been, by the time I was in high school when we kind of quit doing that, I'd been to at least 3 games at Clemson, and we'd park up behind the old Clemson house and walk down to the stadium. I never envisioned that I would be a professor here in a mere 18 years back then, but I did. I became a season ticket holder in football in 1978 and have been ever since. So I'm been a fan of Clemson football and a big fan of Danny and Dabo. And so many people don't know that Clemson had 3 notably successful coaches, and they have one thing or several things in common. They all went to Alabama, played at Alabama, became head assistant coaches at Clemson, and were promoted to head coach without any head coaching experience anywhere else.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Frank Howard, Danny, and Dabo. And so whenever people get on their high horse, when you hire a coach, you've got to have someone with head coaching experience. And I say, yeah, like Tommy West. Yeah, Tommy Bowden, Red Parker. So we've had plenty that had head coaching. So if you're hiring somebody with head coaching experience, you're pretty much 100% guaranteed they were fired somewhere.
That's a good point.
But Frank, Danny, and Dabo were never fired when they were hired. And unfortunately, Danny was kind of forced out with Bill McClellan in the stink with Atchley.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you.